The following session took place at the 17th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Save a Life, Save a World, a suicide prevention workshop with Dr. Christina Ortiz.
This is data from 2020. In 2020, 12.2 million adults, 3 million teens reported having serious thoughts of suicide. 1.2 million adults and 629,000 teens reported having attempts. Those were the number of suicide deaths that year. This is 2020. We have data from 2021, 2022. I didn't get up here, but all these numbers have increased. So we're up to 48,000 suicide deaths a year. And this is just in the United States. And again, these are reported. Way more attempts and thoughts of suicide occur without us even knowing. Suicide, 12th leading cause of death. 126 people die by suicide each day, right? And so that works out to, I looked at one statistic, it said one suicide death every 11 minutes. It is a third leading cause of death for our teens. But really, anybody can be at risk, right? No matter what age group, ethnicity, socioeconomic status. I've worked and talked to children as young as 6 experiencing thoughts of suicide, who've attempted, right? So it doesn't really, any age. Now, if you've never experienced thoughts of suicide yourself, you might be wondering, what can lead someone to have thoughts of suicide, right? Where do they come from? In life, we usually have, right, this is our path of life, right? And this is, I'm gonna introduce you to Adam. Adam's here, he's a happy-go-lucky guy, he's in his early 30s, and he can see his future. That's the line, right? He can see clearly. He is really motivated to go to law school. He is a paralegal right now. And he just started dating somebody who he really is sure is gonna be his future wife. They are getting along very great. He feels connected to his family. Things are going well, right? He sees his future, family, marriage, you know, good career. All good for him. But some things can happen to his life. I'm going to tell you a situation that happened to him. Well, the paralegal office he was working at, it became overwhelming. It was a lot of work. He was feeling a lot of pressure. The company itself there was a lot of pressure, and they ended up not being very successful, the company, and he needed to be let go. So they let him go. He just lost his job. The relationship, the person he was dating, they started having some conflict, particularly conflict about his ability to find another job. And they started arguing a lot, and she started feeling, you know what, I'm not sure if you're going to be the one that's going to be for me. I'm not sure that you can support me or kind of provide my future that I want. And we're not getting along, and I'm just not sure this is going to work. And so she ends up ending the relationship. He's under a lot of financial stress. He was paying rent, and now he is not able to afford the rent that's coming up. There's a lot of pressure there. He wants to go to his family for support, but unfortunately, they do not have a lot of financial means to support, to pay his rent. And also, they're kind of mad at him because they're saying, hey, you lost your job. Maybe somebody should take some responsibility here. Also, why didn't you save enough money up for the next month's rent? What's wrong with you? And also, we probably think you could have done more to save that relationship. Well, one of the things that he does for coping is he works on his health, right? So one of the things he does is he likes exercising. He loves going on runs. He goes on long runs. And unfortunately, during one of his runs, he tears his Achilles tendons, and now he can't run. So his health is affected. His one coping strategy. he's experiencing a lot of loss, right? He's questioning his identity. He lost his job, his relationship. He feels a loss in his health, his ability to cope. And for the first time, he experiences questioning who he is. And he experiences depression for the first time. And so if you can see here, there's a lot of things that piled up. And his vision of the future isn't quite clear. He can't really see it at all. And he might experience something like this. This is something like tunnel vision, where it's really hard for him to envision a future, right? He can't see the future, and when he looks back, it's hard for him to even see what went on that went well in his life. And this occurs because there's something, a concept called mood congruent memory. You'll see this when you're having a good time and you're connecting with friends and family and you guys are reminiscing about all the other good times that you've had. Same thing happens when you're angry, right? If you're ever angry at your spouse, it is really easy at that moment to start thinking about, you know what, let me pull out some other reasons I'm angry at you. When we're overwhelmed or stressed or depressed, it is much easier for us to pull those memories, and that's what happens when somebody is in this state. They might also feel like a burden. They might feel trapped, like they can't get out. They start to feel hopeless that things are going to change. They might feel helpless to change them. There's a term by suicidologist Thomas Joyner. He coined the term psych ache because it's very painful to be in this state. It's very painful to sustain this experience. And it makes sense that sometimes when all of this is happening, one would want to escape and one would start considering perhaps death or suicide as a way out. All right, so what happens when somebody tells us that they're thinking of suicide? What's your initial reaction? Don't do it. Something like this, yes. You're like, oh my gosh, don't do it. No, stop, right? You want to protect them. You want to keep them safe. You want to tell them things like, it's going to get better. Think about all the things that you have going well in your life. You know, think about your family. Think about your friends. Here's a therapist. Call them, right? We want to give solutions and try to fix. Because we ourselves are very scared and we're concerned. That's our initial reaction. It's not the reaction that they need. I want you to imagine that you're in a dark room, your room, and you've been there for quite some time. You know everything that's around. And somebody barges in and turns on a bright spotlight, kind of like that one, my face. But it's in your dark room. What does that feel like? Little jolting, shocking, a little confusing maybe. Maybe you're a little frustrated, right? Instead, let's take you back to the dark room. And instead of somebody coming in, barging in, turning on that bright light, because maybe they're uncomfortable with the darkness, and they come in and they ask, hey, how long have you been here? What has it been like in here? Tell me what's going on. You know, I want to support you. And they're calm and they're not scared. It is much more likely with that approach of curiosity and calmness and non-judgment that the person's going to be able to turn on that light for themselves. They're going to feel empowered. That's your first tool, is to stay in the darkness. That was something I learned very early on when working for the crisis line. Stay in the darkness, stay in the darkness, stay in the darkness. Now, what are you doing in the darkness? You are also doing other things. One of those things is you're looking for something, and you're looking for ambivalence. You're listening for their reasons for wanting to die. You do want to hear those. and you're also looking for the reasons for wanting to live. People who are thinking about suicide have both. And we want to hear what those are. There's a lot of theories about why somebody experiences thoughts of suicide or why they attempt suicide. This is one of them. I'm going to tell you this. This one's called the interpersonal theory of suicide. And that theory is that when there tends to be three things in common that what occurs before somebody makes an attempt. One is if they feel like they're a burden, right? I'm a burden. They might say things like, I just caused trouble, or I'm too much, or my family would be better off without me. They also have a sense of feeling like they don't belong. Nobody really wants me. I feel alone, I feel isolated. They might genuinely have no friends, or if they have friends or they have family, not feel connected, right? They feel like they're a burden. They feel like they don't belong. Just that alone can create a desire for suicide. Now, what makes it really, what we're really concerned is the capacity is the capability for suicide. And when those three things kind of come together, that's where the theory says an attempt can be made. Things to know, let's think about what are the things that, the capability piece, the capacity. What kinds of things that increase capability? What are these risk factors we want to know about? So some behaviors or characteristics. First off, I'll start with mental health issues, right? So one of the most common ones, depression, anxiety, specifically, there's a strong association between panic disorder, PTSD, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia. These all just increase the risk. Other behaviors, isolation, right? Isolation from their family, friends, communities. Other things, I should say characteristics like maybe they're really irritable or angry, violence, history of violence. Depression doesn't always look sad, right? Especially for men, especially for adolescents, depression can look like anger, irritability. Behaviors like maybe they're doing other self-harm behaviors. Maybe it's not suicide, but they're cutting or they're abusing substances. Crises, of course. So, for example, losing their job, losing a relationship through death, or maybe a loss of a friendship, a divorce. Maybe they've gotten a serious health diagnosis, right? Maybe they're going through pain. So whatever, like these current stressors can increase a risk. Family history of mental health issues, family history of suicide losses. Just knowing somebody who's died by suicide increases somebody's risk. Their own history of thoughts of suicide, of attempts, right? I talked to a lot of people and I asked them, you know, how long they've had thoughts of suicide. Some people tell me since they were a kid, since they were a child, 16 years old, maybe. So I always want to know, how long have you had these thoughts? How long have they been going on? Have you attempted before? Just like there are factors that can increase risk, you also want to know about the protective factors, the things that prevent or can lower the risk, right? So these are their internal resources. Do they have coping skills? Right? I'm not going to read all of them, but these are some examples. Right? Are they really good at problem solving? Right? Do they have emotional intelligence? Do they know what they're feeling? Are they attuned to their body and can name those emotions really well? Right? Are they connected to their faith? Do they feel like there's a purpose, right? Like their pain that they're going through, there's a purpose with it. Of course, their external supports, and particularly those supports that they are the supports available and able to listen and help. They may have a lot of supports or know a lot of people, but do the people care, and do they have the capability of helping them? Access to care, of course. So can they get access to professional care if they wanted to? We want to know that. Invitations. Invitations, you can think of them as warning signs, but I like to think of them as invitations because warning signs tells you to go the other way. Invitation tells you, get closer. So we want to look at them that way. So invitations, right? Things about their appearance. Has their appearance made, are there any changes in their appearance? Are they showering? Have they stopped showering? Have they stopped doing their hair, makeup? Just whatever is a general change, you know? So we're gonna look for changes in their appearance. Statements, obvious ones can be, you know, I don't wanna live, I don't wanna be here. They might state that they're suicidal, or they might not. It might be like, I can't do this, it's overwhelming, I don't know why I'm here. Feelings or affect, right? Similar to what I shared in terms of, you know, mood changes. Behaviors, so are they giving things away? Are they saying goodbye to people? Did they write a suicide note? Have they wrote a will? I've talked to a lot of older people and they said, and one of their behaviors is while they're thinking about suicide is writing a will. So I asked them, have you done anything to prepare for a suicide? So you might want to know or observe these. Writings, drawings, especially our artistic folks or our youth, right? They might draw things, sad faces, people crying, maybe like things related to death. I remember this one girl I was working with. She had, I don't know if you know the frog Pepe. It was just a frog that cries. And she had like Pepe everything. And it was a change. Mom was worried. And she even had it as like her profile picture. And and then she started really getting into like goth. It was a change. Not like that, just because you're into that sort of thing doesn't mean you're thinking about suicide, but we wanted to know like, oh, this is a change in behavior. Now, stigma makes it hard to recognize. It also makes it hard to share. I've talked to a lot of people who attempted suicide and they said, oh, I knew about these invitations. I made sure not to show them. I didn't want anybody to ask. Right, so they're not always gonna be here because there are a lot of people who are so scared about the being judged. They might feel guilty for having their thoughts or ashamed and they don't wanna share, so there might not be. But if there are, you know, we wanna recognize them. Okay, so let's say you've recognized that there are invitations here and you're ready to have that conversation. There are different approaches that you want to take when talking or asking somebody about suicide. You do want to be direct. You want to, and I think there's a slide that's coming up, but just I'll say right here, you want to ask directly about their thoughts of suicide. Are you thinking about suicide? Are you thinking about ending your life? And the way you want to have a conversation is to get to that question is you want to build rapport. This is your relationship. You want somebody to feel safe even telling you in the first place, right? So there are going to be certain things you want to do and don't do. So in red, those are going to be the things that you don't want to do. In green, those are going to be the things that you do want to do. You do not want to move away from the painful topic. So basically, if you open the door, you see the darkness, you don't want to close it and run the other way. You want to approach, go inside, and listen. Be very curious without judgment. This means holding back any criticism. Things like, what are you thinking that for? What's your problem? What's wrong with you? You want to identify what they're feeling and validate those feelings. So whether they're feeling overwhelmed or anxious or angry, whatever the emotion is, say, yeah, that makes sense. It makes sense that you feel that way. It makes sense that, you know, with Adam, right, that you were let go and your girlfriend broke up with you and you're feeling lost. Again, holding off on the don't do it response or giving solutions. It's gonna be really, really hard, but that'll come later. So don't worry, that there will be an opportunity to offer solutions, but that's not gonna be your first approach. Because if you go right into solutions, they're gonna think you are not comfortable having this conversation. You can express concern and empathy. Now, for parents, this will be the extra challenge. Expressing concern and empathy without breaking down and crying and getting overwhelmed. Now, it's easier said than done, but I will say I've spoken to a lot of people who I've asked, why haven't you opened up to your parents or, you know, family member? And they say, well, if I do, they're going to cry and they're going to be overwhelmed. And I'm already feeling like a burden. And so I'm going to tell them I'm experiencing this and I'm going to cause them so much pain. I don't want to do that. So by you kind of doing your best, expressing your worry, concern, but staying calm, they're gonna feel more secure in opening up and telling you this information. Of course, you don't wanna minimize or discount. Don't say things like, you don't really feel that way, it's not that bad, look at the bright side, you're thinking about this all wrong. You don't wanna say things like that. You never wanna say, it's not that serious. You definitely wanna take all the thoughts seriously. So be direct. Are you thinking about suicide? Are you thinking of killing yourself? I remember early on, I was like, you want me to ask what? But isn't that gonna make them think about suicide? Are they gonna feel terrible if I ask them that? No, that's a myth. You cannot make somebody think about suicide unless they're already thinking about suicide. They're already thinking about it. You can't make them think about it. But you can give them an opportunity to share that and open up about that experience. And if you're able to be direct and you're able to be calm and non-judgmental, they're going to say, hey, I can talk to this person. This is a safe person to open up to. So you can use those invitations, right? So you can say, hey, right? Have things gotten so hard you've had thoughts of suicide? So you're not just like pulling out the suicide question out of nowhere. You have your reasons. You saw the changes. When you say you really don't think life is never going to get better, right? You can use that and say, do you mean you're thinking of ending your life? Or sometimes when people are going through grief, right? They can have thoughts of suicide. I've talked to many people who've had a loved one pass away and they have thoughts, I want to be with that person. So we just ask, you know, is this something you've been thinking about? And even in that tone, so kind of staying away from like, ooh, you're not thinking of suicide, are you? That gives a message that you don't want to know. Thank you for telling me. I can see that you're in a lot of pain right now. You can express empathy. You know, I am worried or I am concerned. And they might be too, right? They might not have had a history of suicide, so they're not used to the suicidal thoughts, and they might be very scared by the thoughts themselves. And you're offering, hey, let's talk about this. So use those invitations. Deal, in order for us to find out a solution, and we're gonna get into safety planning, we need to know what the problems are. Because how are we going to offer a solution for something we don't know what the problem is yet? So we're going to try to get their full story. this is their opportunity to talk about where those thoughts of suicide come from. This is the opportunity to say, hey, these are the things that led me into that tunnel, I think. Now, this is very important. We need to know how at risk are they, or how safe are they in terms of acting on those thoughts of suicide? Do they have the desire to die by suicide? We're going to find that out by just asking if they're thinking about suicide as well. Do they have the intent to act on those thoughts? I spend a lot of time talking with people who experience thoughts without any intent, right? They're just like, oh my gosh, I have these thoughts. No intent on acting on them. We want to find that out. Very different from somebody who is having the thoughts and saying, oh yeah, I have full intent on acting on this. So we want to know there's a difference. Capability, those are those risk factors that we went over. So we're just finding out if they have any of those. Buffers, these are those protective factors, those things that perhaps are related to their reasons for wanting to live. So I'm going to start with desire. I'm going to get a little bit into what does, how do we find out if somebody has the desire? So one of the things that tells us about desire is asking, are they having thoughts of suicide? If no, have you ever thought about suicide? Somebody that day that you're talking to might say no. And then you ask, well, have you ever? Oh yeah, last week, right? So we want to find out how recently, how often, and then knowing that theory, the theory, interpersonal theory, do they feel like they're a burden of other to others? Are they in that tunnel? Right? Are they feeling alone? Are they feeling trapped? So that's where you can get at desire. Capability. Those risk factors, have they ever attempted suicide before? High risk factor. The ones that are underlined are the ones you definitely, definitely, definitely always want to ask. Have they engaged in self-harm? Right? Lost or known a loved one to die by suicide? Do they have access to a gun? A lot of people who die by suicide, that is in the United States, this is the number one method, the most common method. Why? Because it's the most lethal. Also because it's a method that somebody, if they're in the suicidal state, they act on, there's no time to get help. On the crisis line, we've gotten a lot of calls where people have taken pills or they started doing something and they call and they have time, we have time. But with a gun, we don't. So always find out if there's a gun or they have access to one. And, you know, when you're asking them, like, how, you know, you've thought about suicide, how, what have you been thinking about using? You know, what's your plan? You want to find out if they have access to that plan. These other two are the changes in mood, right? Violence, any mood changes. Another behavior change that I mentioned earlier, but if they're sleeping more, sleeping less, changes in appetite. They're the intent. This one, very important. Have you already done something? Have they already taken steps towards a suicide? And what is their plan? You know, you can ask it this way. Have you thought about how you would kill yourself? And then get the details. This is going to be probably the hardest one, is to be like, okay, I found out they have thoughts of suicide. Eek! I don't want to know. I'm scared. You know, this is the one where you're going to really bring out that courage and a curiosity and just see where their thoughts are. Do they have access to those means? Have they thought about when? Is somebody saying, I'm experiencing these thoughts of suicide that are coming, and no, I don't have any means or I don't have a plan. Very different than somebody saying, yes, I have thoughts of suicide and I'm going to go to the gun range next week. Two different information. We want to know that because the safety plan is going to look very different for those two people. This is a question therapist I recommend asking as well. On a scale from 1 to 5, where 1 represents not likely, 5 represents extremely likely, how likely are you to act on those thoughts? it's a tool for us to know where they are, and then also a tool for them to use for themselves. So this is like a therapist's thing. We can always ask. It's like getting to checking somebody's temperature. Those buffers I told you about, you know, this is where you can, again, you're not telling them what their buffers are. There might be an urge to be like, think about, you know, you just got enrolled in school, you know, don't, you know, think about your family, think about your friends. This is where you're actually going to allow them to identify what their buffers are for themselves and recognize that ambivalence. The ambivalence is really important because without that ambivalence, without them recognizing their ambivalence or reflecting the ambivalence, it's going to be really hard for them or for you to move into identifying a safety plan. Now, the safety, getting them to safety is going to depend on where their risk level is. So the D here stands for desire, capability, and then it's C, and then the I is intent. So if they have all three, you're going to be thinking, okay, my friend here, he's at high risk, or she's at high risk, or if they only have one, you know, maybe they only have the desire, no capability, no intent on acting, probably at lower risk, especially if they have support, if they have those buffers, but they could be moderate risk if they don't have any buffers. So it's just a tool that you can kind of think of in the back of your mind, like, okay, desire, capability, intent, where are they, how high are those buffers present? It's not an absolute, right? This is just kind of like a, this is called the Columbia scale. So it's kind of like estimation about their risk. That's what we can do as therapists, as friends and family members. We can only give an estimation. So this is kind of like the assessment, safety assessment is a tool. This is another tool therapists will use. So if you're a therapist here, you probably heard about the Columbia. We give it out. I give it out every intake. A lot, you know, if I don't see a client for like a month, I'll give it out every month. Some of you have seen these at your own doctor's offices. It's just another tool. It's called the Columbia. You can find this online. So there's a lot of resources online. One of them is this Columbia scale. And it is another tool to say, hey, where's this person in terms of high risk, moderate, or low? Now they've recognized their ambivalence, or you identified, hey, Adam, you know, I see all the reasons why you want to die. You know, it makes sense. You're feeling overwhelmed. You're feeling like you're feeling hopeless that things can change. I also hear that you really care about your family and you want to make them proud. And I hear how you really want to get into law school, or you wanted to get to law school, right? That was important. That having a family is important to you. Those are some reasons to live. And I really thank you for trusting me enough to share your thoughts with me. You don't have to carry this alone, right? We can find resources. This is where you start to get into like, hey, there are people who can provide support. And it may not be you. You might just be the shepherd to kind of like take them to the support, right? But you're kind of, this is your opportunity to say, hey, there's ambivalence here, and there's possibly help. There are other options besides suicide. We are not taking suicide off the table. We are just kind of like adding other things on the table. Okay. So what are some other options? And you're going to ask them, hey, you're not going to tell them what their coping skills are. You're going to ask them, what has worked in the past when you felt this way? If you've never felt this way, what has worked in the past when you felt overwhelmed? Has there been a dark time in your life before? How did you get through that? You want to find out they have strengths. So this is an opportunity for them to draw upon their own strengths. You might need to help them. They might be like, ooh, I don't know what to do. You know, I want to see a therapist, but I don't know, where do I even start? So you can start in giving them options. You know, have you thought about, if they're having like a spiritual or existential crisis, have you thought about talking to your rabbi? Have you thought about talking to your brother or your friends about this? Right, you're just offering, you're not telling them. And now is your opportunity to go into a safety plan. Hey, we're not, you know, what do you think about, for right now, you know, putting suicide, you know, it's still on the table, but what do you think about holding off right now? And maybe there are other ways that you can, other things you can do to end your pain. Let's come up, what do you think about coming up with a plan together to keep you, to ease the pain you're in right now, to keep you safe? So what goes into a safety plan? What you all have right here, and there's some, if you have extra to pass it around, I do have extra. There are safety plans that therapists will use. I'm gonna give them to you even as a family member so you have an idea of what goes into one. And you can do this with your, even with your loved one right away, right? You don't have to be a professional to come up with a safety plan. So what's a safety plan? A safety plan is writing down a list of coping strategies. It's writing down a list of resources. It's a plan for self-control. It's not a promise. It's not a contract. It's a, hey, let's come up with a plan for staying safe that you can read and you can access and that you feel like you can agree to. It's a way to survive and counteract the crisis. There are a lot of people who, well, therapists used to do this. We don't anymore, and I hope that there are still people who do, but I hope that it's significantly lower. Therapists or psychiatrists used to be like, oh, you're thinking about suicide? Here, sign this paper and promise me not to die by suicide. And the client's like, okay. But it didn't do anything. They didn't tell them, how do I stay safe? In that state, when they're thinking about suicide, it's really hard to problem solve. It's really hard to think of solutions. And so it means so much for you to take the time and sit down and say, hey, let's come up with a little plan. Pull out a notebook, just like the notebooks you have in front of you right now, and just write some things down. So what goes into a good safety plan? Knowing their warning signs. What are the things that spark those thoughts of suicide? Maybe it's an argument with a family member. Maybe it's talking about finances. It's good for them and to identify for themselves, to have that insight. Oh, these are the things that lead to my own thoughts of suicide. Because right away they're gonna know, oh, this thing is happening, I'm gonna use my coping strategies. And what are those coping strategies? So internal coping strategies, these are things like, that can take their mind off thoughts of suicide, right? Reading, it might be reading for them, journaling, meditation. You all in this room have your own personal coping strategies that you do to self-soothe, right? They also might have some, so you wanna talk about those. And they might be very different than yours. So for me, I love meditating. It's like my thing. But for a lot of people, it just makes them feel anxious and doesn't help, and they want to like get out of their head. So you're not gonna, this is not to say, hey, do this, do that, this is what helps for me. You might offer that as a solution for them to write down, but you're not gonna tell them. You're gonna have them identify their own. Another part of a good safety plan is distractions and engagement with people and places. And it doesn't have to cost money. It could be, you know, hey, going to the park or a coffee shop or spending time with your grandkids or seeing your grandparents or seeing a friend. You know, it doesn't have to cost money, but it's just being around people, a change of environment, getting out of your room maybe. And then personal support. Who are you gonna ask for help? Ideally, it's somebody who knows about their thoughts of suicide. And if it's not, if they say, hey, nobody knows right now, like you're the first one, you're the only one, you can say, hey, let's write down maybe some other people you'd be willing to tell. Or who do you think really would want to know? You know, maybe it's not something that somebody that they're ready to tell, but maybe put a question mark like, hey, I know for sure my sister would want to know. You know, she'd be devastated if I died and she were to find out. I know that she would have wanted to do something. And so, okay, let's write your sister and maybe, you know. Who to ask for help, professional. So these are their, this is your opportunity to say, hey, this is, you know, who's your therapist, psychiatrist? If they don't have those mental health resources just yet, you can just put their, maybe it's their primary care physician, their hospital, their community center that has professional support, maybe it's their rabbi or their other community, other professionals out there. This is where they just write them down. And then a safe environment. So all those questions in the beginning where you're asking like, what, you know, what's your plan? What's your means? This is where we kind of being like, okay, so you know how you mentioned that you were thinking of using pills? Well, do you have access to those pills and where are they? And they might say, oh yeah, I have those pills. Those pills are, I have like a few bottles from a past injury that I had. And so you can say, hey, you know, what do you think about to keep yourself safe that you get rid of those pills, right? You're feeling okay right now, but if you're overwhelmed and in crisis, a lot of people can just impulsively act on those thoughts. You're feeling overwhelmed. Let's talk about how to separate you and those, the means, the items, and having that hard conversation. Now, there might be people who you will come across who are like, I'm not ready to get rid of their means. For a lot of people, having some people are going to be very relieved to get rid of them. I've assisted a lot of people getting rid of those means, but some people are not going to be ready because going back to the, remember being in the tunnel, they might feel like that they're the suicide is their only escape. And so if you're, they might feel like they can't get rid of their relief just yet, right? So we can say, okay, you're not ready to get rid of them, but maybe you can just put some space between you and the items. Maybe put the items in a box, in a box, in a box in the garage, you know? Or sometimes people are like, oh, you know, knives or something. You're like, okay, well, I'm not gonna get rid of like knives in the kitchen. I'm not ready to tell my wife that I'm having these thoughts. So if I get rid of the knives, you know, yeah, I'm not ready there. So it's like, okay, well, what do you think about putting pictures that remind you of your reasons for living? Or that your the reasons for you not dying? If the reasons, for example, pictures of your children or pictures of that favorite time that you had with your buddies, you know, in front of the knives, something like that. So you can get creative there. So in closing, summarize that safety plan. Hey, do you feel like this plan's gonna work for you? Check in with them. This will also make sure that you're not the one writing the plan, because if you get to this point and they're like, right, you might be like, oh wait, maybe I wrote this plan for them. I was giving them too many solutions. You want them to make sure that they have take ownership over that. And if not, you know, what else can we add to the plan to help it work for you? Will you be able to stay safe for now, or safe for now until our next phone call, until our next of your therapist, our next appointment, until I, you know, I'm going to call you tomorrow. If you're a friend, I'm going to call you tomorrow. Like, can you stay safe until then? If they are actively suicidal, so they're saying, I'm having the thoughts of suicide, and they're happening right now, and I'm even having intent, and I, like, safety plan, like, they're beyond, they're high risk, right? You do not leave them alone. They are not ready to be left alone. So you will now work on, with them, how to do an emergency intervention, right? So it might be like, hey, let's come up with a plan how you're not alone for the week. You know, who are you gonna stay with tomorrow? You're gonna stay with me tonight, that's a good plan, or, hey, if, like, you might not have the capability for them to stay over with you or stay with them, so, hey, let's get to a hospital or a urgent care. I'll take you, or I'll wait with you, we'll call, you know, we'll call somebody to take you, or I'll call, you can always call, by the way, you can always call 911, and they have something called a welfare check, where law enforcement, you tell them ahead of time, this is mental health, and they'll have officers go and just check on the mental health welfare. So you give them, tell them exactly what it's for. And I've done a lot of wellness checks for people, and they just, hey, are you okay? And when they're not, they'll take them to the hospital. Involuntary intervention is the last resort. Absolutely last resort. It can be very traumatic for somebody who just tells somebody they're having thoughts of suicide, the person freaks out, calls 911, next thing you know, they're in the hospital. You know, it's very scary. They and it could leave some emotional scars. And boy, will they have a hard time opening up about their thoughts again in the future. So we always the last resort. And you're gonna explain what you're doing. So whether it is going to the hospital or, you know, if it is, hey, I'm gonna check up on you tomorrow, I'm gonna give you a phone call, whatever it is, you're gonna just kind of plan with them what's gonna happen next for them. Always continue that safety assessment. So just because you asked once doesn't mean like, whoo, I'm done. Check in with them. They wanna know, you know, you wanna know, are they, how are they doing with their thoughts of suicide? You know, have things gotten better for them? So this is the model that we use, I use in general, right? I could go on, I could do like hours and hours of talk. This is like a whole course, suicide intervention and prevention, right? But I try to give like a snip of, hey, these are like the basic tools that you wanna have when supporting somebody with thoughts of suicide. Build that relationship, see where they are in terms of safety and risk. Make sure you have a lot of the information, and then use that information for safety. And then closure, and think about how are we gonna support this person next? Thank you.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.